Welcome to Q&A with TNK. They've surfed the interwebs. They've contemplated, ruminated, and speculated. They've checked the teletype, and now they're ready to answer your questions. Here are your hosts, Tiffany and Kristen.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Q&A with TNK. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Tiffany.
Welcome.
Welcome, welcome to Free to Learn, part two.
Woohoo! All right, so in this episode, we're going to try to tackle a few... what we really want to tackle is how we can incorporate elements of play into our lives in general, because play is how all people learn. It looks different for all ages, but how can we incorporate elements of play, small scale, so like in our lives and our kids' lives and our community,
and how
we can incorporate it more on a larger scale if you've got the means and drive to do something more large scale. And then also how, if you're a teacher who teaches in more of a, well, in a traditional school setting, but are very interested in play and the method of learning through play and curiosity and wonder, how you can incorporate little bits of Sudbury, or if that's even possible, or little bits of play-based learning into elementary school, junior high, high school.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's what we're going to talk about.
That's a lot to talk about.
It is. So this might be a long one.
Free to
That's
learn.
Okay.
If you haven't read it yet,
pause.
I encourage you to read it when you're ready.
Yeah. Yes. I like that, because everybody will be ready at a different time.
Uh-huh.
And that's how all people learn.
Uh-huh.
Yep. So let's talk a little bit about how, so the premise of the book is that all people learn through play. All people.
Yeah.
Adults, teenagers, children, we learn through play. And what that is that it's basically self-chosen, self-directed learning, that you're curious about, something you're curious and you wonder about. And that is the driving force to learn anything. Mm-hmm. So how can we incorporate that into our, like, personal lives? How do we do that in our family life at home?
I think a lot of people already do it, and they don't realize they're doing it.
Exactly.
Anytime you're like, I really need to figure out how to, like, switch this garbage disposal with the new one. I don't want to pay someone, so I'm going to watch this YouTube video.
Yeah.
And do it.
Totally. Or, like, switching out your tail light on your car. Like, I YouTube that and figured out how to do that. And so I could, yes, because, like, why pay somebody to do it when there's a YouTube video?
Yeah.
Our world, everything is right at your fingertips with the internet, and you can learn so much from just a Google search.
Yeah. I think about gardening as a perfect example of this.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, like, some people do if you're really into gardening, but if you're just starting to get into gardening, you don't enroll yourself in a college level class in order to do it. You get some books, you look stuff up on the internet, you make a Pinterest board of, like, flowers you like, you know, you don't, it's more of a personal progression into gardening.
Exactly.
And less of a, well, my teacher told me I have to do it like this and like this and like this. And maybe if there's a specific skill, like, I need to learn how to prune an apple tree, and I don't understand from these pictures, so I'm going to call somebody who knows, or call a master gardener, or, you know, it's much more of a grassroots approach to education.
Totally.
When you think about the gardening example.
My question is this is all deep again, but so why is our society built upon, you know, jobs, our careers are built upon this college education, when maybe what you went to college for isn't, like, you're not super into, but you just did it because you had to, because you were 18 and you had to choose something to learn about. But you might not be totally immersed in it.
Yeah. You're talking to a biology major.
Yeah. So it's how can we change that thinking? Here's another deep question to hire based on your own personal journey, experience versus a degree.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, that's a huge cultural problem.
It is.
Because there is this view that experience isn't as good. When I would argue that experience is better because you know what you want and you're motivated to do it.
Totally. Oh, we need to be president. I say it every episode.
Someday Kristen will be president.
Oh, no. People would not. No. No.
How about Secretary of Education? That might be a good one to aim for.
That would be a good one. We need Peter Gray to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peter Gray. You need to be.
Have you thought about getting into politics?
Yes, please do. Okay. Yes, I agree with you. People, back to our question, mm-hmm. you're learning all the time. Mm-hmm. People are learning all the time. So we've already got that covered. Mm-hmm. How can we, so we send our kids off to school or preschool or daycare, and then they come home and we maybe don't have, a lot of us don't have control over what is happening at daycare or preschool or school. Mm-hmm. So how can we bring play into our kids' lives after school?
That is an excellent question.
I think it is taking away something. I think taking away organized activities is a huge way to be able to embrace a more curious and wondrous and playful lifestyle at home and learning through play.
Yeah. With the clause that if your kid loves soccer more than anything in the world, and when they're home, they're playing soccer, they're learning about soccer. If that's important to them, let them do soccer. But don't put them in taekwondo and gymnastics and soccer and a French program.
Yes. And does organized activities. So say you love baseball and your children are on traveling baseball teams all summer long, and that my best friends, I don't know if she listens to this. I love you, Beth, if you're listening. And she knows that my views on what my views are on organized sports and things. But her family, I mean, and they love it. Her boys love it. And that's what they spend their summer doing, is traveling everywhere for travel baseball teams. And her kids are in sixth grade, I believe. And fourth and sixth. And so it's like, that's what they do. That's what they spend their time doing. And the kids love it. However, the whole family has to go. So does the second grade daughter love it as much as their brothers? I mean, you also have to think about that dynamic too. Like, is your whole entire family having to go along with to these things and losing their chance to play when they're sitting at all the organized activities with, is it healthy for everybody that's involved?
Yes.
So I think that's something that parents need to think about, is what one child doing impacting the whole entire family? And is it impacting in a positive way, or is it impacting in a negative way to anybody? Because if it's impacting anybody in a negative way, then we have to reassess.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would look like for your family, but smaller scale, how can we incorporate more elements of play? I think neighborhood.
Yes.
I just yesterday read a whole thing about a playborhood that somebody created in the yard, and I linked it on Facebook to some of my neighbors. I put their names in it because I was like, oh, we need to create this for our kids. This is what, when I was younger, we had run of the neighborhood. And Peter Gray even talks about that in the book, that like kids were outside in the 1950s all the time. Like, we played outside. We did pickup games of baseball instead of organized traveling baseball teams. It was, you know, you go to the neighborhood park or empty lot and you play a game of baseball with your own rules. And maybe there's only two bases, not four. You know, it was it was all based on the group of kids and what they decided the rules were. And kids would be without adults. Like, there wasn't adults standing there saying, oh, wait, you have to have four bases. That's how you play baseball. Mm-hmm. Who cares? Like, let them create their own game. So that's the kind of culture I would love to have for my own children, and they haven't experienced that yet. And so I linked my neighbors with small children, because there's only a few on our road. We live in a resort town, and we live near a lake where our home is. And so there's a lot of summer homes on the lake that are empty for a lot of the year, or have just retirement folks in them. And so there's only, in our whole entire neighborhood, there's only a couple of houses with kids. So I said, we need to create this. Like, our doors are always open. And then one of my neighbors replied and said, coffee's always on. Let our kids roam. And so that's what I want for my kids. And I, you know, let's create that. Let's meet our neighbors, throw neighborhood block parties so that everybody can meet. So we know who's watching our kids when they're down the road, so that we can check in with them and say, have you seen my kids lately? You know, where are they right now? So we can kind of keep track of them a little bit. So we have that ease, you know, that sense of peace that we know kind of roundabout where our kids are at any given time, because we live on a lake. And that can be a little bit risky when you send your, you know, 7-year-old out who maybe isn't a strong swimmer. I mean, that's something we think about in Minnesota. We live in the land of 10,000 lakes. So there's lakes everywhere and there's water everywhere. So I don't know. I think we need to create playberhoods.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that. Playberhood.
Playber. Yeah, that was a good term that they used.
Uh-huh.
What else can you do
on a small scale? I think...
Find a play-based program for your children. If you're a parent listening, play-based daycare, play-based childcare center, or play-based preschool. Mm-hmm. If you have young kids, that would be something that you could do on a small scale, where they really value play and child-directed learning, it's more of a peaceful environment for children to be able to have that time to just be. Mm-hmm. Just be kids. Give people time.
Yeah. I would also throw out thinking about your children's space and helping develop a playful space.
Yeah.
So I just read an article about how to build a more playful Reggio environment. Mm-hmm. And it was 100% applicable to parents and households, not just centers.
Okay.
About, like, how do you encourage your kids to play with sticks more? How do you focus, you know, instead of having like a giant toy box full of plastic toys, how do you focus your toys so that they are more playful?
I like that.
How do you, just build a more playful environment? And I don't think that means buying new things or getting rid of toys or anything like that. An example would be my grandma and I built little house frames for my Barbies out of shoe boxes.
Oh, yeah.
And suddenly the play is different and more enriched. And so how do you listen to what your kids are into and really focus that play in a new way?
I like that. I like that. I like that you said you don't have to get rid of what you currently have. Just you find different materials to work with, mm-hmm, that are maybe trash to somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, the shoebox thing. I used to make floor plans for my Barbies out of wooden blocks when I was little. I would line them all, like make huge creations on the floor of rooms. So the blocks became like the walls, and it was like a floor plan of this room. And then I used like decks of cards for beds and just like random things for furniture. And I would create this amazing architectural design out of blocks and loose parts, I guess is what we would call them now, but I didn't know that term then.
Yeah.
So
I love loose parts. Let your kids play with weird stuff.
Yeah.
My grandma had a drawer of kitchen utensils that I would just love, you know, I'd play with the water and get out the weird old egg beaters. And like, I still don't know what half of those kitchen utensils were for. Why did she have any of these?
I don't know.
She made spiral mac and cheese and minute rice and chicken every day. Like, what?
Why did she have these weird things?
Have these weird tools? And I'm looking back, it was probably that she found it and was like, this is weird. Tiffany would love this.
Yes.
But, you know, like, don't limit yourself to think that play and learning is only with kid toys.
Exactly. Well, if you think about, like, I look at my son, Knox, who is 1.5. His favorite toys this morning were a set of headphones, like the ones that you're wearing. Not the ones that I had on earlier, but a different pair.
Over the ear headphones.
And so they have a cord attached to them to plug into the computer or whatever device you're using. Mm-hmm. So he found a tiny little hole that fit that little cord perfectly on our, it's on our piano where one of the little knobs had screwed off to open the piano lid. And there was a tiny little hole there and it fit the little jack perfectly. And so he spent probably about a half an hour plugging it into that little tiny hole, then trying to put the headphones on, and he couldn't ever get them on. And then unplugging it and then saying no, no, no to the cord and then plugging it back in and then purposefully unplugging it after he couldn't get the headphones on and no, no. And the whole entire time he's carrying a chapstick, because to him a chapstick is like a very cool possession because the lid comes off, smells good and tastes good. It feels really cool when you swish it with your fingers. And then there's a satisfying snap when you snap the lid back on.
Ultimate toy.
Yeah. That is what he plays with. And that's, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be a toy. Mm-hmm. So allowing those moments to happen.
And I'm going to use another personal example. Ooh, that's kind of a crazy one. I loved video games when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
I don't think video games are anti-play.
Right.
If all you do is play video games all the time and you don't think about anything else, that's dangerous.
Right.
Just like anything, if you're completely focused on one thing yes. all the time, that's unhealthy in my mind, regardless of what it is. But with video games, I loved SimCity. Specifically,
okay.
SimCity 2000 was my jam. And
got it.
We would play, you know, you can only play for so long. My friends and I would play together. You'd only play for so long before it's like, oh, this hurts my brain. Like, we've been sitting here forever. So we'd stop. And then when we stopped, we would design, just like you said with your floor plan, we would draw our dream city and design it. And like, oh, we had to be able to get the water from the water tower to the houses. And like, mm-hmm. ooh, we want a stadium over here. We would spend hours city planning and learning about what that was.
Right.
How do you build a road? You know, like thinking about it like that stemmed from a video game.
Right.
So I think that a healthy amount of video games is okay too.
I think so too. My kids love to play like Minecraft. Mm-hmm. And my daughter just actually bought SimCity, I don't know, 4 or something like that. Mm-hmm. 3. And installed it on our computer. And I don't know how much, I mean, she doesn't play it very often because I don't think she really knows exactly, she should take lessons from you. She doesn't know exactly how it's played, I don't think yet, but yeah, I think video games are okay. My kids play, and I do limit their time mm-hmm. because one of my children, my son, that's all he would do if we let him, like, is play video games. And I don't know. I wonder what Peter Gray would say about that, because I know that he mentions video games and Free to Learn mm-hmm. and how SimCity, I think he referenced actually in the book. Do you remember that?
Game?
That it's a game. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. a good game to play. Am I thinking about the right book?
I don't know.
Or was that Unschooling Rules?
That might have been Unschooling Rules, but
okay.
I don't remember.
Well, it would be interesting to see what Peter Gray has to say regardless about video game play. And brings me back to when you said when you're doing too much of something, like obsession over something, if that could be, if that's bad. But I have an obsession over education and how people learn.
Yes.
And I seriously spend a lot of time researching and reading. Not all of my time, because I know as an adult how to compartmentalize.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like I'm doing good because of it.
Yeah. I think so it sounds like you have a healthy attachment.
Right. I wonder what an unhealthy attachment would look like.
I have an example.
Okay.
I used to knit to de-stress myself in college.
Yeah.
And I would knit all night long.
Oh.
I knit so much that I ruined my shoulder.
Oh.
Gave myself tinnitus and bursitis at the age of 19.
Oh, my.
From just, like,
knitting.
It was all I did. It was such a stress reliever, but at the same time, I was already so stressed out that it was just like, knitting, blah. And so at that level, it's unhealthy.
Totally.
There, you know, I could have been sleeping. Wouldn't that have been a good choice?
That would have been.
Yeah.
Did you ever knit a sweater for a tree?
No.
Oh.
Are you talking about yarn bombing?
Yeah.
No, I haven't done that.
Okay. So let's talk about how, so if you're a teacher listening, regardless, like preschool teacher, if you're a elementary school teacher or I think we need to take it away from preschool though. Maybe elementary school and junior high school. If you're a teacher in a public school setting or even a private school setting that is really interested in kind of the playful learning, the democratic style learning, learning through curiosity, I think is what it boils down to, is how you can incorporate that into your public school or private school classroom. What do you think?
I think the first step is to release some control.
Yeah.
Have some time. Like, start in the corner, as Bev Boss would say.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Bev Boss, we miss you already.
Yes.
Start in the corner. Start by, hey, we're going to do, I don't know, some choice time.
Yes.
I feel like choice time has disappeared.
So the choice time, though, because some teachers say, oh, you're going to have choice time, but here's your choices.
Yeah.
You have to take that away. You can't. There's no here's your choices. It's this is your choice time. Choice time. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Play.
Exactly. Play. And as a teacher, that doesn't mean that you say, okay, maybe free time might be a better word, because choice time is such a.
Yeah. Free time.
Like they don't have a choice.
Free time.
Free time. As a teacher, you don't just say, okay, you have an hour of free time. I'm going to answer all these emails.
Right. You need to be still present.
Yeah. And during that time, as a teacher, you are observing and listening and watching and really seeing what kids are interested in.
Yes, because then you can take that information that you gather during that time and make it a launching point for future things.
Yeah. So suddenly all the kids are drawing maps and treasure maps. Oh, as a teacher, you can then say, oh, they're into maps. How can I scaffold their learning about maps, but also geography and geometry? There's so many things that go into
reading
that.
And writing.
Reading,
and
yeah. So many things make that up, that one thing that they're already interested in. So then next time you can provide big pieces of paper and rulers and, you know.
Okay, can I take this is just getting me really excited because this totally correlates to something that's happening in my life right now.
Yeah.
And it's all about, it's on the same topic. So, and this kind of goes into what you can do on a larger scale. So I am a mover, a shaker, and a doer. Mm-hmm. And this Free to Learn book did change my life. And I am currently trying to get an elementary school up and going in our community that embraces play and embraces free time, but that also uses that free time to scaffold learning. So I don't know if it's like, I don't know if I want to talk about it because if, you know, Peter Gray listens and he hears like the type of school model that I'm trying to create. See, here's the sticky thing is that, we kind of talked about this in the last episode, is that we want learning to be accessible to all. And when you have to charge a tuition, or if the time and energy of like the director of a school or the teachers of a school is spent fundraising to be able to get children to be accessible to children, does it take away learning? Does it take away... So that's the sticky point, is like, do you create a public free tuition? There's no tuition school, but you still have to, so like a charter school.
Yeah.
Do you create a charter school that that embraces innovation, like playful learning and free time and learning through wonder and curiosity. But you still have to be accountable to standards and to standardized testing. Mm-hmm. Do you like sell yourself over so that it can be accessible to more students? Yeah. Or do you create a private school where you can go full Sudbury because you know it works, you believe in it, but it's not going to be accessible to everyone?
That is such a conundrum.
It is. So I've kind of really like thought about it over the last 6 months and did a lot of research. And so we are trying to create a charter school that's innovative. We had to write a letter recently when you have a charter school in Minnesota, you have to have an authorizer. So the authorizer basically is the liaison between you and the state of Minnesota, the Department of Education. So you have to have this organization authorize you. So you have to actually apply to the authorizers. They have to say, yes, your school model sounds fabulous. We'll work with you. So we had to send a letter of intent to apply, the first step. And the letter of intent was due last week. And the whole entire first four pages referred a lot to Peter Gray's findings in Free to Learn and how people need to have time and people need to have free play. And so I don't know. I mean, this kind of the large scale is creating a school that embraces free time and play. And how much? Like if you're in a public school setting, you're accountable to all these standards and the standardized tests. How much free play can you give to students? How much time? I don't know. Yeah. It's a good question.
You'll be the one finding that out.
I guess. So, so let's go back to then how can you incorporate? Yeah.
I think that this speaks to something that I think about a lot, is that there are two approaches to changing education as a field. Yeah. One approach is being in it and moving something that already exists in a direction of change. Mm-hmm. So working in a school that you don't agree with their practices. Not that you went into it like, oh, I don't agree with them, so I'm going to change their mind.
Right.
But if you're in a situation where you don't agree with their practices or their opinions, working to educate other teachers and educate those around you about like what is best practices and what does research say is good for kids, and pushing the system in a direction of change is one approach. And then the other approach is starting from scratch. I feel like there are two ends of the spectrum, and someday we'll meet in the middle. So the other end of the spectrum is starting from scratch and building what you want to see.
Exactly.
And I feel like you are a great example and an inspiration in my mind. You inspire me. Of somebody who knows what you see as working for kids and building it and making it happen so other people can see your example and say, look, it does work.
Exactly.
She is proof.
And you are a good example on the other side of the spectrum of you love your program that you're working in, but see that, you know, there could be some changes that could be positive for your program and for the school system that you're in. And you are doing a fabulous job of educating people through this, through the podcast, and through, I'm sure you have lots of conversations with people all day long about things that could make public school better in your district.
Yeah.
So.
And that's not to say that our district isn't amazing right now. There's always room to push for positive change.
Exactly. Totally. You're doing an awesome job at that.
Well, thanks. You're doing an awesome job on your end of the spectrum. And here we are meeting in the middle.
We are. Totally. That's kind of cool, isn't it? That we kind of came to that realization just now. So what else can teachers? So teachers.
Classroom.
How teachers can incorporate it. So giving a little bit of free time and then using that as a launching point for future learning. What else can we do?
Other things are creating a democratic environment in your classroom.
Yeah. Everybody has a vote.
Everyone's voice is heard. And the teacher does not have additional votes.
Right.
There's no super delegate in that being the teacher. That's not how it works.
Right.
An example that happened to me super intensely, and I needed to check myself. On Friday, we were reading a story, and the kids were super into it. They loved it. And then I was like, well, do you guys want to read another one? Like, thinking in my head, like, they're loving this. Let's grab another one. Let's keep going. Like, I even have one on the same theme, ready right here. This could be great. We could talk, like, compare and contrast. And I started it one page in. They're all just like, I'm hungry. I'm hungry.
Did you keep going?
Well, I went on for a couple more pages. And then I realized, like, who cares? We'll go to lunch 15 minutes early.
Yep.
Like, I even told them, hey, it looks like I need to turn on my listening ears a little better. Sorry about that. Let's go to lunch.
Yeah, good for you.
Which is hard. As a teacher, you feel like, well, you know, 15 minutes until lunch, and, like, the AM kids don't have a lunch in their lunchbox, so they'll flip out. It's two kids.
Yeah.
They know how to open their lunchbox and have whatever snack they didn't eat because they never finished
exactly.
Their food.
Exactly. There's been many times where I've stopped a book halfway through because nobody was listening. And there was one time where I actually shut the book. Nobody even knew if I had finished it or not. I was like, well, I'm glad we stopped that book. You know? So maybe that's another thing that teachers can do is just watch how your kids are, you know, during your lessons, if you're spending more time like managing behaviors and like getting people to listen and hovering so kids know that you're watching them because you know they're not listening, maybe it's time to reevaluate a little bit and figure out a way that find something that they're more interested in. But then in a public school, this is another question.
I'm thinking about middle school. Middle school is the hardest one in my mind.
And I'm thinking, like, sixth grade is what I'm thinking. Like, if you're supposed to be teaching about the Revolutionary War, I don't know what grade you're supposed to teach that in, but if you are, and there's some kid, who cares? Like, they have zero interest in it, but you have to teach it because it's on the list of standards for that grade level, and they will be tested on it. Like, how does that work?
That is a toughie. I wish that one of my friends, Cassie, is attempting something in her high school AP US history class right now. And Cassie, I know you're listening. Prepare yourself because I'm going to want to hear all about it soon.
Yeah.
She read Free to Learn.
Okay.
She designed a new unit that involved, hey, kids, we've been doing this together for a while. Here are the state standards that I'm required to teach you. How are we going to learn them?
Ooh.
Turn it back
there
around.
There you go. You know, in our quest to open a charter school, we visited a lot of schools that uses project-based learning as as their model of their curriculum model. And it's a thing. PBL.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Totally. So that's the other kind of driving force of our charter is that we will be a project-based learning school. And so that looks different for all grades. And the schools that we visited in Minnesota, you know, have mixed age level classrooms, and like the fourth, fifth, and sixth graders are all together, and they have the same teacher through fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. They call them advisories. They're in the same advisory with the same advisor.
That's how our middle school works too.
Yeah. And we went and visited middle schools and high schools with this whole philosophy as well. And it's amazing what kids learn when they are able to choose what they're interested in. So like an example in a high school was there was a high schooler who was so into diesel mechanics, and he was like really intrigued with how engines work. And so he came up to the advisor. They each met with their advisor every morning, and he proposed his project, and he said, well, I don't know exactly like what my project wants to look like, but I'm really intrigued by diesel mechanics right now. So and then the advisor said, okay, so how they have a whole kind of like checklist of how to go about posing a big driving question for the project. And so she's like, well, let's check out some books from the public library. So they went on the public library's website and did the searches together and found some books, and he held them, and he was going to go walk over to the public library and pick them up at some point that day. And you know, start paging through and try to decide then what the driving question would be for his project. And then those students at that school, and I don't know how this would look for elementary, we're going to figure that out eventually here, but how the kids all have the standards in their agenda books, like their planners for the year, and they mark off the standards as they hit them. So they are in charge of their own learning, and that's the teachers. Awesome. Yeah. And there's a whole online kind of tracking tool for that, that they use to make sure that every standard is being met through their projects. So in elementary school, I think it looks a little bit different. I know that like in kindergarten for project-based learning environments, the whole class kind of tackles a project or a theme or a topic that they're all somewhat interested in. I mean, not everybody. Yeah. It was dinosaurs when we went to visit, and not every child's going to be completely intrigued with dinosaurs, but they kind of took what the majority thought seemed cool, and then, you know, the next time maybe they'll choose something that the kids who weren't interested in dinosaurs were interested in, and then they create a whole project together for kindergarten and first. Yeah. And then they just kind of learn through about how to do a project in kindergarten that way, kindergarten first. There was a third grader in this project-based learning school who...
What was the name of the school?
This school is called MNCS, Minnesota New Country School. And they started 20 years ago with junior high and high school, and they just recently added an elementary school about 3 years ago. So we went and visited both. We went the high school, middle school, and then the elementary school. But this little boy, his project last year when he was in third grade, he's now in fourth grade, I believe, he was totally intrigued with 3D printers. And so the teacher said, okay, so what's your driving question? I don't know what the driving question was, but he researched what is a good type of 3D printer, what you need to have in a printer, and how they work, and how much they cost, and where to buy it from. And that is what he did. Then he found funding for the 3D printer. I don't know how he did that. I don't know if he called up community members and said, here's what I want to do, if he called up businesses, but he got funding for this 3D printer, purchased it for the school, amazing, taught everybody in the school how to use it. And then he went on to a teacher conference in Minneapolis and taught teachers how to use this 3D printer.
Amazing.
Third grade. When we walked into their classroom, there was children learning how to do HTML coding.
Who are amazing.
Like fourth grade. And I'm like, I don't even know what that is.
Amazing.
Amazing. And it's because they are allowed to develop their own curriculum during that part of the day. It's the end of the day. Kind of they get the last hour for projects every day. And they get to guide their own learning during that time.
That's amazing.
It is.
That might be a way that in your classroom you can start incorporating some of Peter Gray's ideas is instead of teaching all the kids like, oh, we're going to learn all this stuff and then there's going to be a culminating project.
Yeah.
Start with the project and see what happens.
Yes.
I know there's that whole like KWL model.
Yeah.
What do you know? What do you want to know? What did you learn?
Yes.
I feel like those are awesome. We need to use them more and more open-ended.
Yeah.
So with the Revolutionary War example, instead of like teaching everybody about the Revolutionary War and then doing some project at the end, start with the project.
Yes.
They will have to learn about the Revolutionary War to accomplish their project.
Exactly.
What will they learn along the way? Where will it go?
But I also think that these projects need to be given time. I think many times, like my daughter, Sailor, she's like, well, I have this really awesome, like, diorama that I'm supposed to be doing, but I don't have time. It's, like, not put as a priority. It's, like, after, like, this is just the fun part of the work, which the project should be the fun part of the work. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be the sitting down and reading the textbook and then taking a test on it and then getting to do a diorama if there's time. The diorama is, like, the shot. Isn't it like you take the shoebox and you make the little scene out? Is that what that is?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if I would consider a diorama a project. in a project-based learning environment.
Okay. But, yeah, just but, as an example.
Yeah.
So she, I mean, I think that the project has to be given time. It's not an afterthought. It's like the curriculum. It is the thing that's that they're learning.
Yeah.
So.
Now I'm trying to think about, I'm still stuck on the diorama. I'm wondering if I'm thinking of it from my own experience where it's the last thing you do.
Exactly. And that's what it was for her. But what if it was the first thing you got to do is create the shoebox scene?
Yeah.
You would have to learn so much to be able to complete that scene. Yeah.
And what if it was like a whole table in the center of your classroom and everybody added to your Revolutionary War scene?
Yeah.
And then there's a question like, I don't know if they had that.
Right.
1770.
So you need to check that out.
Do they have the technology? Could you do that? Like, the discussions that would come from starting with that.
Exactly.
It'd be really interesting.
Right. And I think, but on the other hand, the little I know about project-based learning is that there's a certain way to do it for it to be effective.
Yeah.
So I think if you're going to incorporate project-based learning in your classroom, you need to really know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So there is a little bit of groundwork that needs to be done to be able to do it.
You might need to do some research about that.
Yeah.
You might need to make your own diorama.
Exactly. So, I think that those are good starting points for teachers.
Yeah.
Do you think?
I think so.
So, on the other end of this,
You know what the best starting point for a teacher would be?
What?
Reading Free to Learn.
Reading the book. Exactly. So, on a large scale, what can we do?
We talked about this a little bit in the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
What would society look like if every school was a democratic school?
Right. We still need to know that answer.
We Peter do. Gray. That, I mean, that sounds like a fun project.
It does. It does. So, we talked a little bit about, you know, we automatically think unschooling with this type of learning, but not everybody has the capability to unschool. So, this is also, you know, I'm trying to create this charter to meet the needs of, you know, the families that don't have access to private education, can't afford it, or don't have the opportunity to unschool their children, to be able to stay home and let their child lead their own learning through life.
Yeah.
So what could that look like? And so this is what I think it could look like, is that what if you could create some sort of a community co-op where it's volunteer-based, you know, find people who are good at something, or I think you would have to hire somebody to kind of facilitate it all. So you'd have to have like one advisor for all the children that are in this co-op. Uh-huh. But then maybe the parents, if you're a working family, but you like this unschool method of learning, unschooling meaning that you let children lead their learning and there's no like curriculum that everybody follows, that you kind of let life happen as it happens. You learn through life. So how could that look for, I'm trying to wrap my brain around this, look for parents who work. So an unschooling co-op where parents pay a little bit of a fee, or they have to volunteer a day out of their week. So maybe you only work 4 days a week and you can volunteer for a full day to be an adult.
Or maybe school happens on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what are your kids?
What do you do with
your
kids during the day?
So
that's why, like, if there's a, you could have an unschool co-op where parents could chip in a little bit of money to pay somebody to help watch. I mean, you'd be watching and kind of guiding the kids. You'd be like a guide to their education. Or volunteer to help with something like that, so that parents who work can have a place. Maybe it's a couple days a week to drop their kids off, and they are in, there's another adult there to kind of guide their learning. So,
yeah. And this speaks to the experience versus education. You could find someone who is so experienced that would love that job.
Totally. Well, and I thought about this. Okay. So here's my idea, because this charter school that I'd like to create may not be a fit for families who want to embrace a more unschooling lifestyle, because there is going to be, it is a school. It is a, it's going to be accountable to standards. So I also need to create an unschool type place where parents who work can bring their kids. And so what I think that could look like is 2 days a week, they bring their kids to a county park that has a building that we can hang out in, an activity room, but you spend time outside all day.
Yeah.
And there's a guide there to be with the kids, to kind of keep track of what they're interested in, and then hand that over to the parents and say, here's what we like really saw. We saw tracks and we did not know what they were. And so we looked it up while we were there and we got the field guides out, but they're really, really the kids today, or your child in particular, was so intrigued by wolves that I really think that you can, you know, take that and you can use that as a launching point for his reading and writing at home.
Yeah. Awesome.
So
I love this in theory. On a greater scale, it requires so much parent involvement.
It does. And I think that people who unschool want
the involvement.
They already want that involvement because they
And if they don't, then that to me, we haven't talked about where unschooling doesn't work.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like parents who don't do it to be involved, parents who do it because they don't want to deal with school.
Right.
Like if you're so lazy that you don't get your kid to learn anything, and you don't, and you're so lazy, I say this, I don't believe that this is how most unschooling families are, but I know that this exists in the world. But if you're so lazy that you don't get your kid to learn, so your kid is failing at school, so your kid hates school, and you're like, well, I don't want to deal with it, so I'm going to unschool. And then you're not involved, and you're just as lazy in your unschooling as you were in your schooling. Like, that kid is learning nothing but how to be lazy.
Right.
You are setting an example for lazy.
Exactly.
And I feel like unschooling works when there are adults that are involved, that are curious about learning, that have that passion for learning. And that is not every adult.
No, it's not. No, some parents want to live this unschooling lifestyle, but they necessarily can't facilitate that. So it would be really cool to have some sort of a co-op where you could send them out with other unschooling families. Yeah. So I'm going to make one in our community, and I'm going to call it Villa Kula Unschool
Co-op.
Because
Pippi!
Just because Pippi.
That's my,
she's like
one of
the
my favorite
ultimate
kids books.
Unschooled, like, live for play icon.
Yeah, that is
so
brilliant.
It's gonna be the Villa Kula Unschool Co-op.
I love it mm-hmm. I love it I have more ideas about how we can implement this on a large scale.
Okay, tell me.
One of them is, what if we start in the corner and one school, you have one classroom that has the teacher that is maybe multi-age, that is mm-hmm. very play-based, democratic, unschool, that one classroom.
Okay.
And to be in that classroom, it starts with people that are interested in that.
Yes.
And kids that the system isn't working for in other situations.
Yes.
So teachers can recommend, like, hey, I think that this learning model might be better for your kid. Like, they would be happier in this room.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are two teachers that bring diverse backgrounds. Because I think that multiple adults is also part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just one teacher who knows. It's multiple teachers. One is interested in science. One is interested in English. Like, having that diversity of interests, diversity of backgrounds is important. And then starting in that corner, you could see how it works. And that way, like, would a public school be able to do that?
I don't know.
Could you do that?
I don't know.
Could you encourage all of the kids in that room to opt out and see what it's like?
Right.
I don't know. But that sounds really fun to me.
It
does
sound
even in like a high school model, like, instead of having these kids go from room to room to room, they have these two teachers and there are 10 kids. And I don't know. It just sounds really intriguing to me.
I don't know if you could ever convince a public school to do that with all the standards that need to, I don't know. It's such a huge mountain, Tiffany.
Would it be like an alternative school within a big school? I mean, I know I have a friend who works in a one room public high school. That's him and one other teacher and like 10 kids, 15 mm-hmm. kids. And it sounds awesome.
It does.
And they're studying for their math project. One of the kids was like, I want to build a drift trike. And Michael was like, I don't know what that is, but go for it.
Go for it. I know at the school that we visited, there was a school called Avalon School in St. Paul. It was a project-based learning school. And we walked into the wood shop. And there was a teacher, like an assistant teacher in there. He was the wood shop kind of director. And there was a student building a skateboard, a longboard. He wanted to build a longboard. So that's what they did. It was awesome. So in Free to Learn, Peter Gray talks about what if there could be community schools. And in the community school, it was like a community center where there was just, you know, library and computers and community members who have a passion for something who can come in and share their passion when somebody young wants to learn that passion. Whether it's woodworking or cooking or whatever. And you could, within that community center, choose your own path.
I love that. Like a hub.
Yes. And I think that would be super cool. And that's maybe kind of almost what an unschool co-op could look like too.
Yeah.
Or even in a smaller, more public-based, that could be part of project-based learning in a public school. Yeah. Is finding community members to help guide learning. So,
yeah. Is that what libraries used to function as before the internet and digital age?
Maybe.
But now we can learn so much on our own.
Right.
That it's like we need to restructure community centers.
Right. Well, I think that's kind of like where education research, the science of education, is moving now. People are recognizing that we have information at our fingertips. You don't need a teacher to teach you anything anymore. Besides maybe like to learn to read. I mean, to help you figure that out. But otherwise you basically can find anything at the press of a enter button.
Yeah.
So I think
what is the teacher's role then?
I think the teacher's role is as basically as a guide now. Like, if we could form this more free school type of method, this unschool or democratic or Sudbury style model, the teachers become more of a guide to ask deep questions to get kids thinking, to get people thinking.
The Socratic method of teaching. I just learned about that. In that awesome book, Fearless Teaching.
Really? What? Yeah. Okay, so tell me, I heard this term a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
The Socratic view of teaching is that it's the teacher's job to ask questions.
Okay.
Not the teacher's job to tell you how it is.
I love that. That's how education should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not a new concept.
No.
Socrates is not fresh.
No. But now it's being applied to the science of education.
Yeah.
More. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very cool. All right. Well,
This was intense. Longest episode yet. Are you still with us, listeners?
I know. Oh, my gosh.
Have you paused to go do something else yet?
Okay, so it's time for what would you do?
Kristen.
Yes, Tiffany.
You have traveled through the mist to a new place and time. Dook-a-dook-a-dook. That was an Amazon Trail reference.
Oh,
video
okay.
game as a child that I played a lot. Oh. So here's the deal. You are walking down the street and it's like an evening. I don't know where you're walking. You're walking to your car from the grocery store. Suddenly this fog rolls in and then the fog rolls out and you, in that moment, had to completely switch your job.
Oh.
You no longer are allowed to work in education because it's an alternate universe. It's a new place in time. What are you doing instead?
Oh boy. I am writing novels, like writing literate, like children's juvenile literature, like fiction.
Ooh, I love it.
That's what I would do. I would write books. But I love it. Like fantasy. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific type of fantasy that you like best?
No. I think, you know, you see all these fabulous authors who, like, have fabulous ideas, like Harry Potter and Twilight and, like, these fabulous series that you're like, oh, my gosh, why didn't I think of that? But I don't have the mind to ever think of cool things like that. So I would want to have my mind would be able to think of cool things like that to write about.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah, I want to know what you would do.
Oh, gosh. I really don't know. Here's a weird thing. I think if I had gone to a different school, I would not be a teacher. I think I would be an orthodontist.
Seriously?
Yeah. And not because I don't love being a teacher. I'm so glad I am where I am now. But I almost went to Oregon State.
Yeah.
And I would have gone a very different route there than I did at Reed.
Funny.
And I'm pretty sure I would be an orthodontist.
Crazy.
I don't know why I have that feeling.
Weird.
It's weird.
But you do have really nice teeth.
Oh, thanks. Mm-hmm. That's 7 years of braces right there.
Seriously? Yeah. I've never.
I think that would be like why I'd want to do it, because nobody else should go through 7 years of torture.
I was gonna say something and now I completely forgot, because I think as soon as like we stop talking about our topic, my brain shuts off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that it's...
Well, would we say that it's...
Yeah, time to wrap up.
Time to wrap up. Well, Kristen.
Well, Tiffany.
It's been fun. We'll see you next time on Q&A with T and K.
Woo-hoo! This has been Q&A with T and K. Thank you for listening. From serious to silly, Tiffany and Kristen are eager to answer your questions. Just email them to q4tnk@gmail.com. That's q4tandk@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with another episode. Music by Kurt Pearsall, Tiffany's sweet, sweet hubby.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.